Good afternoon, Tri-States. You are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. This is Ken in my regular Friday reader seat, reading from the Friday, November 11th. Today is Veterans Day. Friday, November 11th edition of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald. And we begin now with our first piece, page one, above the fold. Our headline reads, 50-year sentence for fatal crash attack. A Dubuque man on Thursday was sentenced to 50 years in prison for causing a fatal crash while on meth and cutting a man with a hatchet in separate incidents. Brandon M. Othamet, 33, previously pleaded guilty in Iowa District Court of Dubuque County to charges of homicide by vehicle operating while under the influence, serious injury by vehicle, and second-degree theft in relation to the fatal crash. For those charges, he was sentenced to 35 years in prison. As part of a plea deal, dismissed were charges of vehicle homicide due to reckless driving, serious injury by vehicle, and involuntary manslaughter. Othamet also was sentenced to an additional 15 years in prison for charges related to separate incidents. The fatal crash on December 5th ended a high-speed chase. Court documents state that Othamet stole a vehicle from a convenience store parking lot at 14th Street and Central Avenue, drove at high speeds on Central Avenue, and then broadsided a vehicle driven by Anthony J. Livens, 63, of Dubuque, at the 5th Street intersection. Livens was seriously injured, and his passenger, Nancy K. Meisenberg, 54, of Dubuque, was taken by ambulance to Mercy One Medical Center, where she died. Police later reported that a blood sample from Othamet showed that he had methamphetamine in his system at the time of the crash. During the sentencing hearing, Othamet said he regretted his actions and asked for forgiveness from the family of Nancy Meisenberg. "If I could take her spot, I would," he said. "I hope you are able to find a place in your heart for forgiveness." Two of Nancy Meisenberg's children, Amber Feldman and Catherine Meisenberg, also spoke during the hearing. In a tearful statement, Feldman condemned Othamet's actions and said she does not forgive him. "I understand that everyone makes mistakes in life and no one is perfect," Feldman said. "But because of your mistake, we lost our mother." Catherine Meisenberg, also crying, said the loss of her mother still haunts her family. "He deserves all he gets for taking our mother away from us," Meisenberg said. Judge Monica Zrini Ackley said she gave credit to Othamet for pleading guilty to his crimes, but the severity of his actions require consequences. "You made some really bad choices, and you have a history of making really bad choices," Ackley said, later adding, "It, to me, seems appropriate to require you to spend a considerable amount of time incarcerated." Othamet also was ordered to pay $150,000 in restitution to the families of the victims in the crash. Regarding the other 15 years of his sentence, Othamet was sentenced to 5 years for dominion and control of a dangerous weapon, and he was sentenced to 10 years in prison for violating his probation in 2021. Court documents state that Othamet got into an argument with his then-girlfriend, Audrey A. Clancy, 33, on October 28, 2021. After Clancy left the residence, Othamet grabbed a hatchet that was part of a knife collection on a wall and began to swing it at Will C. Thomas Jr., 40, who was trying to calm Othamet down. Documents state that Othamet grabbed Thomas by the forehead, and Thomas was cut in the mouth after moving his head, causing a significant laceration. After Clancy returned to the residence, police said Othamet pushed her to the floor, grabbed a rifle from under the bed, chambered a live round, and stood in front of Clancy with the rifle. other charges related to that case, including willful injury, assault while displaying a dangerous weapon, and domestic abuse assault, were dismissed on Thursday. Boy documentary sparks discussion on black masculinity, personal struggle. At least 100 people gathered Thursday at Five Flags Theater to preview an upcoming documentary exploring black boyhood through subjects that include one of Dubuque's own. Caprice Jones, executive director of Fountain of Youth, is one of five key subjects of the upcoming documentary Boy, produced by the Nantucket Project. The 12-minute trailer and extended preview shown Thursday was followed by a panel discussion with a consortium of community leaders. Boy explores black masculinity through a core cast of subjects, an executive with Hollywood Foreign Press Association, a retired Army general, an award-winning costume designer, a Black Lives Matter activist, and Jones, who works with clients such as domestic abuse survivors and inmates in the county jail to help them turn their lives around. It's a story that is little understood and seldom told, said Tom Scott, who is directing and producing Boy. It focuses on the narrative of life as a black male in America. The title is, as the film's subjects note at one point, a double, triple, quadruple entendre when used in the context of black youth. Innocent when uttered from one person's mouth, a racial epithet from another's. The film also addresses the idea that for many black men, their boyhood is something stolen from them, either by violence, personal discrimination, or institutional racism. In that vein, the film details Jones's tumultuous upbringing in Chicago, from witnessing his mother having a mental episode at age 7, to joining a street gang at 12, to more than 2 decades in and out of the state penal system. Many who know Jones are aware of his background. Part of his introduction to visitors to Fountain of Youth's Main Street office is showing a poster board with a dozen of his mugshots from his run-ins with Chicago police. Asked whether he expected the film to change people's perception of him, Jones was resolute. "I've thought about it," Jones said, "but no matter what, the truth sets people free. I'm bringing everything to the table to break bread." That message resonated with many of the event's panelists. Antonio Musan, an instructor of personal empowerment at University of Dubuque, mentioned being moved to tears the first time he viewed the film's trailer. "It speaks to my spirit," Musan said. "I can't help think of all the little black boys here in the balcony, in the crowd. It makes me think about my 2-year-old son who won't have the privilege of boyhood." Several of the event's black male panelists discussed how bias and discrimination continued to affect them in their day-to-day lives in areas such as housing and employment. The men also discussed the pressure of maintaining a certain image for both themselves and their peers. Ternois Fury, City of Dubuque Community Engagement Coordinator, talked about being pulled over by police while visiting a client as a behavioral health specialist after a neighbor found him suspicious. Musan discussed college graduation rates among black men. 3 out of 10 black males graduate college in 6 years, Musan said. "For me, that is a constant reminder of the responsibility I have in finishing my doctorate." Panelists also discussed ongoing discrimination they say they have faced in Dubuque, even outside the experience of black men. Panelists Clara Lopez-Ortiz, a Mexican immigrant who is equity coordinator for Community Foundation of Greater Dubuque, and Dustin Alfred, who works for Crescent Community Health Center, was born in Dubuque and is of Marshallese descent, related being told to speak English by white residents. "Changing that is the onus of the city's residents," the panelists argue, "which means being more open to meeting their neighbors where they are. To a certain degree,
the panel had moved beyond Boy, but Boy was, as Scott told the Telegraph Herald, a film about vulnerability. "Be curious," Feary said, quoting researcher and author Bren Brown. "Hold hands with strangers. Get uncomfortable and be okay in being uncomfortable and being in uncomfortable spaces." Our final front page piece, Area Caregivers Not Alone. And with it comes a large picture of what appeared to be obviously a husband and wife sitting on a couch in their home looking at us. And beneath it, the caption reads, "Larry Metcalf sits with his wife, Susan, at their home in Dubuque. He is the primary caregiver for Susan, who has Alzheimer's disease. This is National Family Caregivers Month and National Alzheimer's Disease Awareness Month." And our article reads, "Larry Metcalf took his wife, Susan, by the hand and gently guided her to across the living room to her favorite chair next to the large picture window. She likes this chair because she can sit and look outside," he said, helping Susan, 72, settle into the cushioned seat in their home in rural Dubuque. Larry, 73, has spent much time of the past 4 years caring for Susan after his wife of 50 years was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. "She has been nonverbal and largely noncommunicative for 2 years due to the degenerative brain disease, which is the most common cause of dementia. An estimated 6.5 million Americans aged 65 and older had Alzheimer's dementia in 2022, according to Alzheimer's Association. As Larry described how Susan's condition has impacted the couple and their family, he periodically paused to steady his shaking voice. It's a horrible, horrible disease," he said. "She raised 5 kids and did a terrific job. And now she can't even take care of herself. It's an awful change." November marks both National Alzheimer's Disease Awareness Month and National Family Caregivers Month. Megan Pedersen, Senior Program Manager for Alzheimer's Association's Iowa chapter, described the month as a time to highlight the work that caregivers such as Larry do on a daily basis. "Individuals with Alzheimer's or dementia tend to have an increased need for assistance, and the impacts on these caregivers can make it feel like they are the only one dealing with this. So it's important for them to know that they are not alone and there are resources available," she said. Larry and Susan met at a dance at Dubuque County Fairgrounds when they were 23 and 22 years old, respectively. The couple began dating and married shortly thereafter. At the time of their marriage, Susan worked as a beautician, but she became a stay-at-home mom to care for their 3 daughters and 2 sons. Later, she returned to work as a paraprofessional at Thomas Jefferson Middle School in Dubuque. Larry worked for Three Rivers FS, selling seed corn and fertilizer to farmers for almost 30 years before both he and Susan retired in 2014. "About 4 years ago," Larry said, "friends and family members started noticing troubling changes in Susan's behavior and personality. She was just acting differently than she normally does," he said, his voice breaking. "She was a great mother and a great grandmother, and she just started to get away from those things." Pedersen said personality changes, such as increased anxiety, can be one early sign of Alzheimer's disease, along with changes in communication and an inability to complete tasks that a person once did easily. "I think the biggest misconception is that Alzheimer's disease is just memory loss," she said. "There's so much more that goes into what Alzheimer's patients are living through." A brain scan led Susan's doctors to diagnose Alzheimer's, which also had affected her grandmother and aunt. Her condition worsened fairly quickly, and now Larry provides around-the-clock care for Susan, including dressing and feeding her. "As it progressed, it was harder and harder for her to communicate with others, and eventually she just kind of quit," he said. "Right now, the biggest problem is that she doesn't want to eat anything. Whatever I make, I have to feed it to her, because otherwise she'll just sit there and look at it. According to Alzheimer's Association, there were 73,000 caregivers of people with Alzheimer's disease or other dementias in Iowa in 2021, providing 60 million hours of unpaid care. Larry said caring for Susan can be overwhelming at times. However, Susan spends one day per week at Cozy Corner Adult Daycare Services in Dubuque, giving Larry time for himself to decompress and run errands. And he said both his family and Susan's are eager to assist if needed. "My goal is to keep her home for as long as possible," he said. "I think that's better for her because this is her house. We've lived here for 38 years. I just can't picture her sitting in a home by herself." Studies indicate that people aged 65 and older survive an average of 4 to 8 years after an Alzheimer's diagnosis, with some living as long as 20 years. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration has approved 6 drugs for the treatment of Alzheimer's symptoms, but Pedersen said there is currently no treatment to cure or alter the course of the disease. However, she said recent research has focused on whether lifestyle factors, such as eating, sleeping, exercise, and social patterns, can reduce someone's risk of developing Alzheimer's or slow the progression of the disease. Larry said that for him, patience has been his most powerful tool in caring for Susan effectively. "You've got to remember that deep down inside, she's still the person she always was," he said. "She just can't express it." Now we turn to news from Dubuque and the Tri-States. At the top of the fold on page 2, country star Moore coming to Dubuque. A country music star with 10 number one songs on the Billboard Country Airplay chart will return to Dubuque next year. Justin Moore will perform at Five Flags Center on Friday, April 21st, along with country artist Priscilla Block, who sings with Moore on his song, "You, Me, and Whiskey." Facility officials shared performance details with the Telegraph Herald prior to their public announcement this morning. Moore has a total of 13 top 10 hits on the country airplay chart. His most recent chart toppers were "Why We Drink" in 2020, "We Didn't Have Much" in 2021, and "With a Woman You Love" in September. Go back to last summer when we had Brett Young and Dustin Lynch. If you take those two out of the equation, this is probably the biggest name country music-wise that we've had since our first show back from COVID-19, which was Lee Bryce, said Jess Gavin, marketing manager at Five Flags Center. "We anticipate people are going to be very excited about it." Moore previously came to Dubuque as part of America's River Festival in 2012. Gavin said the show was brought to Five Flags Center by South Dakota-based promoter Pepper Entertainment, which the venue also worked with for the 2019 show with country artist Cody Johnson. "They do a lot of shows in similar-sized markets, and they're great to work with," Gavin said. "We look to continue to foster that relationship as we see what might happen with Five Flags Center with the change of leadership soon and potential for renovating or expanding the building." General Manager H.R. Cook recently departed, and Aaron Rainey currently is serving as interim general manager. Meanwhile, City of Dubuque officials continue to discuss the facility's future. Gavin noted that Moore's show also will be toward the end of Five Flags' typical busy season, which runs from February to mid-May. Earlier this week, the venue announced country artist Dylan Scott will perform on February 2nd. "We think those will be a couple of nice bookends to that season," Gavin said. "We have more things we're going to announce in the next couple of weeks, but we certainly look to Justin Moore as maybe the capper on that busy season." Tickets for Moore's Dubuque concert will be available beginning at 10 a.m. Friday, November 18th. Ticket prices start at $29.50, and they will be available both at the Five Flags box office and Ticketmaster.com. Tri-State piece comes out of Dickeyville. Officials investigating cause of fire at Dickeyville Hotel. And we have 3 small inset pictures. In the caption beneath one, Fire damage can be seen on Thursday on the apartments attached to Wisconsin Wood Inn in Dickeyville after a Wednesday blaze. And another one from the side of the building. An exact damage estimate from the blaze was not immediately available. And a long shot including the name of the hotel. Renovations and repairs to restore the Wisconsin Wood Inn building will occur once the company gets approval from authorities, a hotel representative said. Now, I'll bet that's all going to be in the article, but here we go. Officials investigating the cause of fire at the Dickeyville Hotel. From Dickeyville. A Southwest Wisconsin hotel will remain closed until further notice following a fire this week that caused extensive damage. No one was injured as a result of the fire Wednesday at Wisconsin Wood Inn, and affected guests and tenants were moved to a nearby hotel owned and operated by the same company in the aftermath of the blaze. Firefighters were dispatched to the hotel shortly after the fire began at around 7:30 a.m. Wednesday. Dickeyville Paris Fire Chief Troy Trost said crews arrived on scene to find smoke and flames on the backside of the building that contains the inn's office, one apartment, and an as-needed living area for employees and inn owners. Three people were in the building at the time of the fire, including the apartment tenants, but all were able to exit the building safely. Multiple fire departments and other area emergency personnel responded to the call, and Trost said the fire was under control at around 11 a.m. The fire did not spread to the nearby hotel rooms, which are in a separate building from the office, but the power is out in the rooms as a result of the incident. "We've been here 7 years, and nothing like this has ever happened," said hotel representative Alicia Mendoza. "It's unfortunate, but we know with Mother Nature that things like this can happen. We're fortunate that we still have the hotel and none of our guests were injured." Trost was at the hotel Thursday afternoon, working to determine the cause of the blaze, which has yet to be determined. He said he did not yet have an exact damage estimate, but that the building experienced extensive flame and water damage from the efforts to contain the blaze. Mendoza said Wisconsin Wood Inn guests and apartment tenants were moved across the street to Tri-State Wood Inn, which is owned by the same company, until further notice. She said Wisconsin Wood Inn had around 10 guests at the time of the fire. Guest Connor Buckles said the move was a little hard after working all day, but that he felt fortunate the fire did not spread to the hotel room where he was staying. He is originally from California and said he was staying in town to do some work on wind turbines in the area. "I came back from like a 10-hour shift to find that outside and have to move all my stuff," Buckholz said from the doorway of his new room at the Tri-State Wood Inn. "It was necessary, but there were some difficulties with it being dark and having no power." Renovations and repairs will take place to restore the Wisconsin Wood Inn building once the company gets the okay from authorities, Mendoza said. We have this inset along with the article, Donations Sought for Family. The Southwestern School District is accepting donations for a district family who lost all of its belongings in the fire at the Wisconsin Wood Inn. The district is accepting items for the family's 8-year-old daughter, including size 10 and 12 clothes, toys, and other related items. It also is accepting household items, such as personal hygiene supplies and kitchenware. No furniture is being accepted at this time. People can drop off donations at Southwestern Elementary School. Now we turn our attention to the opinion page in Our View, Friday's quick takes, which represent the points of view of the Telegraph Herald editorial board. We have a smirky face and two smileys. So let's start out with the smirky face. Salute, honor, and support veterans. Today is Veterans Day, when businesses and citizens are doing the right thing in honoring and thanking veterans as well as active duty personnel for their service and sacrifice. Many enterprises today salute veterans by offering them free meals or car washes, giving discounts for gym memberships, or making donations toward veterans groups. Meanwhile, veterans are the focal point of solemn ceremonies and parades. What folks do for veterans today is commendable, for today. However, the other 364 days of the year? Not enough. This country still has a ways to go toward attaining a level of pride in what it does for its military veterans, mental health services, especially in dealing with post-traumatic stress, and employment are two areas where too large a gap exists between need and reality. Too many veterans fall through the cracks of support services and are left unemployed and even homeless. We as a nation must do more to help this population who put their lives on the line to protect our freedoms. Yes, parades and free pancakes every November 11th are fine and fitting, but the best tribute and proof of our appreciation is for our government to make good on its promises to our veterans. As Americans, we must demand nothing less. Our next piece, with a welcome as warm as Florida sunshine, Dubuque gives a big hello to Avilo, the ultra-low-cost airline that will begin providing flights between Florida and Dubuque in January. Avilo Airlines of Houston announced late last week it would offer direct flight service between Dubuque Regional Airport and Orlando International Airport on Wednesdays and Saturdays starting on January 11th. It will mark the return of commercial air service to Dubuque after the departure of American Airlines in September, which provided flights to O'Hare International Airport in Chicago. Community leaders have been working for months to secure an agreement with an air service provider. Notably, Molly Grover and the Dubuque Chamber of Commerce, Dubuque Regional Airport Director Todd Dalsing, and Mayor Brad Kavanaugh led the tireless effort to develop a deal with Avilo. That meant financial support approved by the Dubuque City Council and the Dubuque County Board of Supervisors, which came through to give Avilo assurances that Dubuque can help them succeed here. In addition to a huge perk for local travelers, the agreement means that employees working at the airport continue to have jobs, and flights to one destination could easily lead to more down the road if local passengers show the demand for services. Let's see how many people from Dubuque will be ready for a trip to the Sunshine State come January. Yes, this will be the beginning of a beautiful relationship. Once again, it's time to fly Dubuque. And our third smiley face piece, or our third piece that's a smiley face, with balmy temperatures earlier in the week, local residents might not be ready to think about the fact that snowy days are just around the corner, but like it or not, tis the season. That means clearing sidewalks is in the near future. Whether you're seeking help with the task or looking for a way to help out your community, the City of Dubuque might have an opportunity for you. City staff is now accepting applications and seeking volunteers for DBQ Shovel Crew, a volunteer-based snow shoveling assistance program. The program pairs volunteers with residents who are physically and financially unable to remove snow and ice from the sidewalk adjacent to their property and do not have other resources to clear it, such as neighbors, friends, or a hired service. To qualify for assistance with snow and ice removal, the property must be owner-occupied and the resident must be physically unable to remove snow and meet the income guidelines. How many people in need help depends on the number of volunteers willing to step up. For more information, contact Rob McDonald at mcdonald@cityofdubuque.org, or better yet, the phone number 563-589-4159. And we have two letters to the editor. The first one, Consider Another Option for Dubuque Middle Schools by Gary Reed, St. Celia Drive, Dubuque. I would offer a suggestion to the group studying two middle schools for Dubuque. It appears that the student numbers would justify two schools. I would propose selling Jefferson to a private investor and putting the money toward construction of a new middle school to be located on the land the PAC occupied. There is plenty of land there and was discussed for purchase prior to the construction of Roosevelt. That would provide one middle school on the west end and the second in the north end. Washington could then be preserved without additional land acquisition for the purpose of an alternative school for grades K to 12, a component currently missing in the Dubuque Community School District. Well, our second letter, pay attention to what's happening in U.S. Earl Guler, University Avenue, Dubuque. Why are we asleep at the wheel? Our power grid is in very poor shape. Our military is unfair, and yet our government is taking oil from our national reserve instead of letting the country be more self-supporting with oil. Our oil reserve is very important for our military and security. We also need to pay more attention to China. They control thousands of our farm acres, river terminals, schools, and more. Now, Washington may be alarmed if China invades Taiwan, but think if China cut off everything we get from them now. We'd be in very bad shape. Drugs, auto parts, almost all electronic components, even the chips for your car. Don't listen to one news station alone. Look around and see what is going on with our country. You are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped, brought to you in part by DuPaco and the R.W. Hafer Foundation. This is Ken, and we are listening to my reading of the Friday, November 11th, Veterans Day, November 11th edition of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald. And we now turn to today's obituaries. From East Dubuque, Tuesday, the love of my life went peacefully to be with his God. Thomas Paul Olinger, 81, of East Dubuque, died November 8th at home with his wife by his side. Massive Christian burial will be 10 a.m. Saturday, November 12th, at St. Mary's Church in East Dubuque, with Father Dennis Vargas officiating. Burial in the East Dubuque Cemetery with military honors accorded by members of the Dubuque Marine Corps League. Visitation is from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday at the Miller Funeral Home in East Dubuque, where a parish prayer service will be said at 3:30 p.m. Friday. Tom was born on May 22, 1941, in Dubuque, the son of Lucille Lucy Hooks and Arthur Ruhr. Tom graduated from Dubuque Senior High School in 1959. He then followed his uncle Johnny's, Jack Specht, footsteps and enlisted in the U.S. Marine Corps. Tom was so proud to be a Marine. He always reminded you that there was no such thing as an ex-Marine, only a former Marine. Tom met his wife-to-be April 22, 1962, when he was home on leave. Tom said it was love at first sight for him. Thomas and Mary Rose Werner were married September 5, 1964, at St. Mary's Church in East Dubuque. They chose to make their home in East Dubuque. Tom was a devoted husband and hard worker. Tom learned the trade of plastering. He was even a manager of General Menswear, selling men's clothing. He worked for Sara Lee Baking Company, formerly Trausch Baking Company, retiring after 30 years. Tom then went to work for the U.S. Postal Service for 16 years, retiring on April 30th, 2022. He was a member of the local BNC union, serving as chairperson until he became a supervisor and a member of the APWU. Tom was a member of St. Mary's Church and its Holy Name Society, a former member of the East Dubuque Volunteer Fire Department for 10 years. As he would say, back in the day, he liked to go hunting with his Uncle Johnny. He enjoyed league bowling with family and friends, but most of all, he loved his family. Tom was a proud and strong-willed man who stayed true to himself. Tom walked to the beat of his own drum that made him a kind and loving man. Tom may not have been a father with children of his own, but his nieces and nephews and even their friends could not have had a better influence or support and love them any way he could. He took them on trips, camping and fishing, weekly cookouts and teaching them games. He took pride in teaching them to play euchre. Tom was blessed when he walked two of his nieces down the aisle. He loved them like his own. In his later years, he spent more time taking Mary on road trips, whether to Ho-Chunk or South Dakota, which was his favorite place to go. Tom took great pride in his Native American heritage, and he enjoyed finding unique items to collect, especially Kachina dolls. He enjoyed going to the Diamond Joe and playing the slots. Then, when most people were planning on retiring, Tom was starting over. This time, a grandnephew was born, and his mom was going to need lots of help to provide for him. Tom was there without hesitation, and an instant bond of love was formed when Tom held Joe. Growing up meant there was a sandbox to make, a treehouse to build, basketball hoop to put up, a bike riding lesson, encouragement with joining karate, and never missing a tournament or school activity. Joe became the son Tom never had. Tom loved and nurtured Joe, always trying to set an example for this child that is now a young man. God bless them both. Tom was very grateful for his family. He truly enjoyed spending time with them, and one of his final wishes was to be able to tell each one of them goodbye, and God granted that wish. Semper Fi, Tom. Online condolences may be left for the family at www.millerfhed.com. Daniel K. Meyer, Burton, Wisconsin. Daniel K. Meyer, 53, of Burton, died Tuesday, November 8th. Visitation will be held from noon to 3 p.m. Sunday, November 13th, and from 10 to 11 a.m. Monday, November 14th, at Martin Schwartz Funeral Home and Crematory in Lancaster, where services will follow. Burial will take place in Burton Cemetery. James D. Russell, Savannah. James D. Russell, 87, of Savannah, died Sunday, November 6th. A graveside service will take place at 10 a.m. Monday, November 14th, in Oak Hill Cemetery in Mount Carroll. Law Jones Funeral Home of Savannah is assisting the family. Margaret V. Johnson, Durango. Margaret V. Johnson, 100, of Dubuque, died Wednesday, November 9th. Visitation will be held from 2 to 6 p.m. Sunday, November 13th at Eaglehoff Siegert and Casper Funeral Home and Crematory, 2659 John F. Kennedy. Burial will be in Linwood Cemetery. Mary J. Amon, Epworth. Mary Jane Amon, 76, of Epworth, and formerly of Dubuque, passed away Saturday, November 5th at her son's home in Epworth after her battle with pulmonary fibrosis. The family will greet family and friends from 3 to 8 p.m. Thursday, November 10th, at the Rife Funeral Home in Farley, Iowa, and after 9 a.m. on Friday, November 11th. Services for Mary Jane Amon will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Friday, November 11th, at the Rife Funeral Home in Farley, with Chaplain Diane Graves and Reverend Michael Schuler presiding. Burial will be held in St. Joseph's Cemetery in Farley. She was born March 6th, 1946, in Manchester, daughter of Clements J. and Marie Soppy Amon. She received her education in the St. Joseph's Schools in Farley, graduating in the class of 1964. She worked at several places throughout her life, and it was always in a caring profession. She was a paraprofessional at Western Dubuque, an activity coordinator at Oak Crest Manor, and at Medical Associates. Online condolences may be sent to the family at rifefuneralhomeinc.com. Arlene M. Moore. Arlene M. Moore, 68, of Dubuque, died Wednesday, November 9th. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Monday, November 14th at Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory, 2595 Rockdale Road, where services will follow. Janet Sullivan, Galena. Janet Sullivan, 77, of Galena, died Thursday, November 10th. Arrangements are pending. Furlong Funeral Chapel of Galena is assisting the family. Patricia M. Dittmar, Scales Mound. Patricia M. Dittmar, 83, of Scales Mound, passed away Sunday, November 6th at Galena Staus Senior Care Community. A funeral mass will be held at noon, Monday, November 14th, at Holy Trinity Catholic Church, Scales Mound, and where friends may gather after 10 a.m. until the time of mass. The burial will be held at a later date. Cremation rites have been accorded. The Furlong Funeral Chapel, Galena, is assisting the family. She was born November 20, 1938, in Galena, the daughter of Clement and Nellie Douglas Kohler. Patricia graduated from Scales Mount High School with the class of 1956. She was united in marriage to Melvin Dittmar on May 16, 1959, at Holy Trinity Catholic Church, Scales Mound. Patricia was a school bus driver for Scales Mound Schools and retired after 43 years of service. She enjoyed spending time at the Diamond Joe Casino and visiting with friends at McDonald's. Ramona J. Krenz, Cedar Rapids. Ramona Jean Krenz, 52, of Cedar Rapids, died Wednesday, November 9th at her home. A visitation will be held from 10 to 11 a.m. Monday, November 14th at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids. A memorial service will follow at 11 a.m. on Monday at the funeral home. Ramona was born February 12, 1970, in Dyersville, the daughter of Joseph Barker and Deanne Dorweiler. She graduated from Western Dubuque High School and went on to obtain her master's degree from the University of Iowa. Ramona was united in marriage to Justin Krenz on October 14, 1995, in Tipton, Iowa. After passing her CPA exam, she worked for Oak Hill Engineering and Ilton's Heating and Air. She was involved in the local chapter of the National Multiple Sclerosis Society. Ramona volunteered for the Cedar Rapids Community School District as a room mom for the elementary schools and served as the accountant for the PTA. She found great joy in helping children learn to read. Ramona was incredibly musical. She first learned how to play the piano, then became an excellent flautist, and she also played the electric guitar. Memorials may be directed to the National Multiple Sclerosis Society, Upper Midwest Chapter, 2829 University Avenue, Southeast, Suite 900, Minneapolis, Minnesota, 55414. Please share a memory of Ramona at www.murdochfuneralhome.com under obituaries. Orville Hesselbacher, Galena. Orville Hesselbacher, 100, of Galena and formerly of Scales Mound, died Wednesday, November 9th. Arrangements are pending. Furlong Funeral Chapel of Galena is assisting the family. Mary L. Mason. Mary L. Mason, 94, of Dubuque, formerly of Bettendorf, passed away November 3rd at Bethany Home Retirement Center in Dubuque. Funeral services will be 11 a.m. Monday, November 14th, at Schroeder Mortuary. Silvis with visitation from 10:30 until service time. Burial will be in Greenwood, or Greenview, rather, Memorial Gardens, East Moline. Mary was born January 6, 1928, in Davenport, the daughter of Henry and Elise Martin Lefebvre. She married Wilbur Mason June 22, 1947, in Portland, Oregon. He passed away January 1, 2014. Mary was a bookkeeper for her husband's business, Mason's Creations. She enjoyed traveling, sewing, cooking, watching cooking shows, and collected hummingbirds. Online condolences may be sent to the family at www.schroedermortuary.com. Norman Muleip, Galena. Norman Muleip, 93, of Galena, died Thursday, November 10th. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Tuesday, November 15th, at Furlong Funeral Chapel. And now we have a couple of births to bring in. We have new arrivals that we want to welcome to planet Earth. Our first one is Wednesday, November 9th. Saunders, Tim and Allison Saunders of Dubuque, a boy at Mercy One Dubuque Medical Center. And we have Uribe Rodriguez Maldonado, Nicholas Uribe and Leti Rodriguez Maldonado of Holy Cross, a girl at Mercy One. Welcome aboard planet Earth, all the little ones.
Take a look at some of our news in brief from this page. Dubuque Library to host food pantry seeks donated items. Carnegie Scout Public Library plans to offer a free food pantry for the holiday season and seeks donations of non-perishable food items to stock the initiative. The pantry will be available during regular library hours from Monday, November 14th through December 30th at the library, 360 West 11th Street, according to a press release. The library is open 9 a.m. to 7 p.m. Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Friday, and Saturday noon to 5 p.m. Oh, that was Friday and Saturday, and noon to 5 p.m. on Sunday. The release states that the food is available for anyone in need. Donations of canned and dry packaged goods are encouraged. No perishable food, glass, or expired items will be accepted. The library also will accept new, unopened personal hygiene items, such as shampoo, soap, body wash, toothpaste, and toothbrushes. Donations may be made at the first floor recommendations desk. Police, two arrested in fraudulent check cashing scheme. Police said two Georgia residents used a computer to create fraudulent checks and paid people to try to cash them in Dubuque. Trevon H. Reese, 27, of Atlanta, and Jada N. Johnson, 19, of Decatur, Georgia, were arrested at about 3:20 p.m. Wednesday in the area of West 4th and Main Streets on charges of second-degree theft and forgery. Johnson also was arrested on a charge of possession of marijuana. Court documents state that officers responded at 11:55 a.m. Wednesday to Midwest One Bank, 280 John F. Kennedy Road, after a person tried to cash a fraudulent check. Bank staff denied the transaction and the man left in a vehicle. Officers spotted the vehicle on traffic cameras and tracked it to Dubuque Rescue Mission, 398 Main Street, where it picked up a person. The vehicle later was tracked to Best Western Plus, 3100 Dodge Street, and Tupaco Community Credit Union, 3299 Hillcrest. Officers located the vehicle returning to the mission at 2:20 p.m. to drop off a person. The vehicle was stopped, and a backseat passenger said she had been picked up by Reese and Johnson and offered $500 to cash a $3,200 check, which she did. Reese and Johnson were arrested. Reese had $11,383.88 on him, while Johnson had $523 and marijuana. Searching Reese and Johnson's room at Best Western, officials found a Canon printer, a Dell laptop, multiple checks believed to be stolen, multiple fraudulently created checks, and blank check paper used to print the fraudulent checks. Dubuque Police, man shared video of sexual act with minor. Police said a man shared a video of himself having sex with a girl younger than 18. Anthony T. Hunt, 18, an inmate of the state correctional facility at 1494 Elm Street, was arrested at 2:57 a.m. Thursday at the facility on charges of first-degree harassment and telephone dissemination of obscene materials to a minor. Court documents state that authorities learned that Hunt had shared a video of himself engaged in a sexual act with the girl. Authorities discovered the video on Hunt's cell phone after executing a search warrant. The Telegraph Herald does not provide identifying information for victims of alleged sexual crimes. Continuing with some more news in brief, missing man's body found near Dubuque. Authorities recently located a missing man's body along railroad tracks just outside of Dubuque and determined that he had been struck by a passing train. The body of Joseph A. Peavy, 21, of Dubuque, was found Wednesday morning lying next to the railroad tracks near the Dubuque County Fairgrounds, according to the County Sheriff's Department. A press release states that authorities were alerted by Canadian National Railroad staff who saw the body as a train was passing through the area. Peavy was reported missing October 26th from the Hillcrest Family Services residential facility at 1160 Siple Road. He appeared to have inadvertently been struck by a passing train sometime between October 26th and Wednesday, according to the release. Peavy's body has been sent to the State Medical Examiner's Office in Ankeny for an autopsy, and the investigation is continuing. Woman accused of shooting gun into air, Dyersville. Authorities said a woman was arrested Wednesday night for firing a gun into the air during a domestic disturbance in Dyersville. Kalia M. Williams, 26, of Chicago, was arrested on charges of domestic assault while in possession of a deadly weapon and possession of marijuana. Authorities were notified of a disturbance with the sound of gunshots at about 5:55 p.m. Wednesday at 505 9th Street Southeast, according to court documents and a press release. in addition to Dyersville Police, the Cascade, Farley, and Piasta Police Departments, and Dubuque County Sheriff's Department responded. Documents state that Williams and Gabriel Thomas of Chicago were located in an alley north of the 1100 block of 2nd Avenue Southeast. Thomas said he was arguing with Williams, with whom he has a child, when she fired a handgun at him. Authorities found a handgun belonging to Williams and two bullets on the ground in the 500 block of 9th Street Southeast. Williams told authorities that she had fired the gun once into the air because she was frightened of Thomas. Authorities reported that their investigation determined Williams fired into the air rather than at Thomas. Authorities reported that Williams was in possession of marijuana and a backpack with 24 bullets. Williams was arrested in the 1100 block of 2nd Avenue Southeast in Dyersville at around 7:55 p.m. City of Platteville's offer for armory rejected. The Wisconsin Department of Military Affairs has rejected a $100,000 offer from the City of Platteville to purchase the Platteville Armory. Platteville Common Council members narrowly approved the offer last month, 4-3, after voting to lower the offer considerably from the department's original $135,000 ask. Council members intended to buy the property and then resell it to give the city more control over which entity moves in and hopefully retain some use of the gymnasium space for city programming. In lieu of accepting the offer, City Manager Adam Ruschel wrote in an email that the Department of Military Affairs is allowing the city some time to search for a buyer willing to purchase the facility for $135,000. The city will put out a request for proposals by the end of the week with a deadline of December 22nd. If a buyer is found, the city would look to close the deal with the department by January 31st. If not, council members will discuss the issue further at their January 10th meeting before officially allowing the property to be put up for public sale. We have in the lifestyle pages an article appropriate for today. It's called A Wall of Healing. It's difficult to imagine now, but the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, one of the nation's most respected memorials on the National Mall in Washington, D.C., was heavily criticized during its design, approval, and construction. It was a big black gash in the ground, hardly a fitting tribute, it was said, to the more than 50,000 service members who gave their lives in Vietnam. All that changed, however, once people could visit the stunning memorial for themselves, once it opened November 13, 1982, 40 years ago. In 1980, Congress authorized a Vietnam Veterans Memorial to be built on 2 acres of land not far from the Lincoln Memorial. A contest to design the memorial attracted 1,421 entries. A selection committee picked a concept created by 21-year-old Yale University architecture student Maya Lin. The memorial would consist of two 200-foot-long reflective black granite walls set below ground level in a giant V shape. Those walls would be inscribed with the names of the American service members killed or missing during the Vietnam conflict, more than 58,000 of them, in chronological order of when they were lost. "I just wanted to be honest with people," Lynn told a reporter for the Washington Post. "I didn't want to make something that said they've gone away for a while. I wanted something that would just simply say they can never come back. They should be remembered." Public reaction was strong. A veterans group protested, claiming the design was an ugly insult that portrayed the war as something shameful and that needed to be hidden or buried. Some high-profile critics even criticized Lynn's age or ethnicity. She was born in Athens, Ohio, to Chinese immigrants. Eventually, a compromise was struck. A more conventional bronze statue, Three Soldiers, designed by Frederick Elliott Hart, that had finished third in the competition, would be installed nearby, 2 years after the main memorial opened. In 1993, another statue would be added to the complex, a memorial to the nurses and other women who served in Vietnam. Since the memorial opened, more than 400 names have been added to the wall. Some had been omitted due to clerical errors. Other deaths were ruled after the fact to be the result of service in the war. Therefore, there are some names not in chronological order. The memorial is open 24 hours a day. Rangers are on duty from 9:30 a.m. to 10 p.m. to answer questions and to help people find the names of their loved ones, making paper and graphite rubbings of the carved names has become a popular way of paying one's respects. And there are many pictures on the page. One of them, the most beautiful, is the wall in a side view in the dark with the lights beneath it that are there. I've been there several times. It's a moving experience just to touch the wall and see the name of fraternity brother that I lost. Take a look at this weekend's buzz. It's going to be a colder one, but nonetheless, we have things going on. Dubuque American Legion Veterans Day ceremony today, Dubuque Ice Arena, 1800 Admiral Sheehy Drive, 10 a.m. The annual ceremony will feature keynote speaker Christine Schauer and music will be followed by a chili luncheon at the American Legion Clubhouse. Event admission free, chili lunch, $1 a bowl. Back home for Christmas Craft Show, Saturday, Holiday Gardens Event Center, 101 Brewery Hollow Road, Potosi, 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. Early holiday shoppers can explore items from local vendors. Refreshments and door prizes also will be available. Admission is free. More information about this event at 608-732-2517. Fall into the holidays, Sunday, Dubuque County Fairgrounds, 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. The 7th annual shopping event will feature local vendors and crafters. Part of the proceeds from admissions will go towards supporting St. Mark Youth Enrichment. Admission is $5 a person. I'm going to read for a few minutes. The Dyersville Man Made Ultimate Sacrifice in World War II. And it's an article about First Lieutenant Lawrence Cruz, considered to be the first casualty from Dyersville during World War II. And there's a large picture of him with the article. Let me begin. I may bounce around to try to get the highlights. For young Lawrence Cruz and his family, things were no different than young men coast to coast going off to the service. Lawrence was born in Petersburg, January 19, 1916. Graduated from Xavier High School in 1934 as an honor student. He was captain of the basketball team, played football and softball. You have been listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicap. This is Ken, having been in my Friday reader seat here for an hour, reading from the Friday, November 11th, Veterans Day, November 11th edition of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald, brought to you in part by DuPaco and the R.W. Hafer Foundation. Remember, there's more than just our voices Monday through Friday to read the paper to you. Tune in to IRIS and find out all kinds of other programming that is available to you out there to help you get through the day, to brighten your day, to raise your spirits, all kinds of good stuff to listen to. So tune in, and you'll hear from me next week. So long until then.